Okay, so I'm going to wrap this up with three slides, I think, on the cognitive stuff. Because the cognitive stuff is easy. We don't know anything about it. Okay, so things that are important to HCI in terms of cognitive abilities include memory and learning. Because a lot of the things we do with the user interface is to rely on people memorizing things like, you know, the vocabulary of gestures or words or actions they have made, they have done, etc. And we also rely on them being able to learn the interface to be able to use it better and better over time. Now memory, you know, there used to be this theory of short versus long-term memory. Short-term being, you know, seen as working memory, temporary memory, small, very low capacity. There's a famous article by Miller, 7 plus or minus 2 items can be stored in short-term memory. You all know that if you look up a phone number in the, I was going to say in the phone book, but never use the phone book anymore. But on the web, and you have to memorize it until you have it. What do you do? Well, you write it, but say you can't write.
I repeat.
We use patterns.
You repeat and you chunk. Or you chunk and you repeat. And so, well, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's different countries. In France, we chunk by two. In the US, it's 3 to 2. And so what Miller showed is that, and this paper you should read, actually, I have to put a pointer to it, is that, yes, we have limited capacity in our short-term memory system, but one way to make it work for larger amounts of information is by chunking things together. So if you try to remember the 10 digits of a phone number, it's much harder than if you do 5 times 2 numbers with 2 digits. But of course, if you try to remember 4 digits numbers, it gets complicated again. So there's kind of a trade-off here. The information gets stored in short-term memory for a short time as well. Well, this is why it's called short-term. 10 to 30 seconds. And so a lot of this relates to what in HCI literature you'll find under the term cognitive load. We try to build interfaces that reduce as much as possible the cognitive load to the user, which is defined loosely as the amount of information that the user has to keep in mind to be able to operate the system. So, and so one way to get to have a smaller cognitive load is to put more information available to the user when he or she needs it. But then you run into another problem, is that you put too much stuff on the screen, then it gets hard to find, and so again, it's a trade-off. So this is short-term memory, and then there used to be long-term memory. And long-term memory is magic. Infinite capacity and unlimited duration. Well, sort of, because at some point, I mean, you know, we're all gonna die, and I don't have this text, but for practical purposes, in terms of user interfaces, whatever is in your memory will not matter at this point. So it's unlimited duration with that caveat. But the point about this, this memory is that access is associated. So, of course, we do forget things. But what we forget most is ways to access things. Now, the picture is a lot more complex. And if you look at more modern models of memory, you have all these types. That's a slide I added. I will put it online, so you'll have the link. This is a nicely done website, by the way. And so you have sensory memory, stuff that, you know, storage is under a second. So immediate storage of what you perceive before it gets processed. Short-term or working memory that I just talked about, and long-term memory, they've done all these categories. That is not to say that we have different parts of the brain versus different things. I think it's still very shady, but there's explicit versus implicit. So implicit and procedural memory is very important for HCI because that's how you learn skills, how you learn to do things. And it's not something you memorize explicitly. I mean, you don't learn to drive by reading a manual. Or you don't learn to bicycle by reading a manual. You know, you need to get on the thing and then it gets into your bones and your muscles and your brain. So that's why it's called implicit memory, because you memorize things unconsciously. And then there's the explicit memory, declarative memory, things you facts you learn and you memorize, you know, your names, your family, and your friends' names and number of things. A lot of this declarative memory is actually being externalized to devices, which is interesting because maybe it's our way for making room for other things to do with our brain. And then there's this episodic and semantic memory. I really like episodic memory. I'm sure you've had this experience where you've seen a fairly bad movie once, and then years later it plays again on TV, and you start watching it again. And you know you watched it, but you don't remember really the end of the movie or what's, you know, the plot. But as the movie unfolds, you know what's happening immediately next. And I think that illustrates this notion of associative memory. Is that because you saw the movie linearly, it's been stored in this kind of sequence where the associations are between one scene and the next. And to trigger a scene, you need to see the one before, because that's how the association was made. Now, you know, if it's a very good movie, or if it's a movie that, you know, you react strongly to, you'll make other links out of association. But this specific memory was probably the primary way in which it was stored. I'd have to find also a link on an article I read in Wired recently. I hope it's available online, which is absolutely stunning and spooky on how to try to erase memories. Which is actually a fairly big deal. Well, probably all have things we'd like to erase from our memory or from other people's memory. No, but more seriously, there are all these people who have had post-traumatic stress disorders, you know, from going to war or being exposed to dramatic events, and so it would be really cure for these people. What the article explains is apparently the way when you recall things in your memory, it's not like in a computer where it's stored in memory, you read it, you have a copy of it, and the original stays there, and you can do what you want to copy. Apparently, when you retrieve, at least for some aspects of this memory, when you retrieve a thing from memory, it's taken literally out. It's the original that is taken out, and then gets stored again immediately. And so and in fact, it's also because, as we were just saying, if I want to remember the number of today, I repeat it myself. So I memorize by repetition. But apparently, that's also how memories get stored. And when you recall something, it gets stored again. So this process is used again. And so if you can get right in the time between where your memory has been pulled out and before it's pulled back in, if you can use a drug that will block whatever needs to be blocked, then your memory will be gone. And they seem to have drugs that start being able to do that. So, anyway, so highly irrelevant to our field for now, but...
Procedural memory is this habits? Like, you could say that?
Yeah, skills, tasks, habits, routines, things...
Chores.
And again, I'm really no expert on this, this is very, very high level. I found this website, which I discovered, in fact, yesterday, because I thought I needed to have something a little bit more up to date on this. And it's nicely explained there. So this is about memory. I didn't say much of anything about learning. A lot of learning is done through reinforcement, doing the same things again. And so it's, of course, an argument for having user interfaces that are consistent, so that what you learn in one user interface you can apply to another, and that reinforces it. But anyway, I don't have time to go into more detail. I want to give you two pieces of theoretical things that are very popular in the HCI literature. One is action theory by Van Norman, and the other is plans and situated actions by Lucy Satchel. And the second one, again, you don't have in your slides. So Don Norman is a cognitivist.
Yeah.
He was a hardcore psychologist at the University of California at San Diego. And towards the end of his life, when he became sort of a senior researcher and wanted to move on to other things, he got interested in the human-computer interaction. He wrote this book that was first called The Psychology of Everyday Things and later The Design of Everyday Things. He worked at Apple when Apple still had a research lab before 1997. And now he is a consultant with Wake Up Medicine. And so this is work that he did when he was sort of shifting his interest from pure cognitive science towards computers and computer systems. So that dates back to the 80s. And he made this model of, how do you interact with the system? And the idea is that, you form an intention. Okay, I'm going to write a report today. And then you specify the sequence of actions that need to be carried out to fulfill this goal. And so the specification of actions, I'm going to find a word, I'm going to open it, I'm going to create a new document. And of course, this is hierarchical. You can have high-level goals that you refine in sub-goals, etc. And then you execute those actions. And that's where you hit the system. And then the system does something. And you perceive the results of these things. The result can be nothing happens. If nothing happens, if you try to click and nothing happens, it tells you something. It's a kind of response, which is either I'm not doing the right thing, or the system is dead, but it is something I can perceive. So on this side we have the execution side, and here we have the evaluation, which is, did I get to the goal I had set? So you perceive changes in the system, or lack of changes, you interpret them. So if I drag a file to the trash can and the file icon disappears, I observe that, my interpretation is the file is gone. And then my evaluation is this what I was trying to do? And so you have to imagine this into a hierarchy of goals and sub-goals, each of them having this kind of loop. So you go from high-level actions to let's write a report, to low-level actions like let's open a file and type thing and copy and paste and all the individual actions you do at the interface. So this was developed or used to explain the advantages of direct manipulation over command line interfaces. So early 80s, again, this whole time where direct manipulation emerged. And so what Don Norman says is that you can have some notion of execution distance and evaluation distance, which is the amount of effort to go from an abstract goal to a sequence of actions that you enter into the system. And his point is that if you have a command line interface, there are several distances here that are pretty large. One of them is execution means typing, long lines of text. Specifying actions, between intention, I want to remove a file, and having to know is called RM, and then I need to put the file name. And compared to a situation where I see the icon of the file, I see the icon of the trash, I put the file into the trash. So his point was this distances could be compared. I mean, not with a measure where you can use a yardstick or a timer, but something where conceptually it seems easier to see an object, move it to a trash, than have to remember a sequence of keyboard commands. And the same thing goes on the other side here. In the original Macintosh, when you put a file to the trash would inflate, get bigger. So it told you, the file is—it's not disappeared; it's in the trash. And in fact, if you open the trash, the file was there. So it reinforces that thing. So the interpretation again can be, and I say can be, it's not always the case, but easier on the graphical user interface if it's well designed than on the command line. On the command line interface, oftentimes when things do what they should do, they tell you nothing. In fact, like RM file name, if the file exists, the next thing I get is the prompt. I only get something from the system if the file doesn't exist or I couldn't remove it because I don't have access rights. And I can guarantee that I don't know anybody who, after an RM command, doesn't type ls to see if it's really gone. And even though, I mean, you know, even if you on Unix for 20 years, and you know that if it didn't tell you anything, it's gone, you have this reflex. What?
Don't type it.
Yeah, well. I wouldn't take your word for it. You would do it once in a while. Maybe not immediately after, but I have observed
not
that.
After each successful code.
No, not each one. I'm pushing it a bit.
I know if there is no feedback, it works. Because anyway, when there is no feedback, when there are errors.
I know, but the thing you know intellectually and the things that you do without thinking, it's different things. We did a study in 2000, we were creating this editing system. It was a graphical editor, and what we observed is people seemed to spend a lot of time aligning objects so they would look nice. And we had done a lot of video observations, so we had data about this. I said, you know, they obviously spend 25% of their time aligning things. So it would make sense, right, to optimize this. Then we went to interview those people, and, you know, in the middle of the interview, without making a big deal about it, said, by the way, you know, how much time do you think you spent aligning things? And it was between 5 and 10%. People, and the funny thing is, during one of the interviews, the guy, the whole time, he was fiddling with this drawing while we were talking. He was not even realizing he was doing it. So I trust you to say, well, I have a mental model, I know what's happening in the system. I don't trust you saying, well, I don't use LS. Because I'm sure you do, but you don't realize. And it's no big deal, I mean, it's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. But oftentimes the perception we have of what we do is very different from reality. Which is actually a problem when you evaluate interfaces. Because you can evaluate interfaces objectively by measuring things and having, you know, hard data. You can also evaluate them by asking people, what do you like it? And so when you have a discrepancy between the two, when the data tells you this method is less good, but the user data tells you they like it better, what do you do? On the one hand, you know, if you do the rational decision, should be to give them the best interface, even though they don't think it's the best. But maybe the right decision is to give them the thing they like best. And we find this sometimes. Because people, the perception that we have of time, the perception we have of and that will come into the next slide, the perception we have of how we do things is often idealized. And again, it's natural human thing to abstract things out, to look at patterns rather than details. So, I don't know, you should run an experiment on yourself, see how many times you run LS. Here's the thing, you replace LS by a command that does nothing, or that, I don't know, flashes your screen or something, so you'll notice. Because I know I type LS without being aware of it.
I could look into the history.
Yeah. Oh, the history, yes. And you know, for every rule is an exception. So that's the other thing about human behavior, is you always have outliers. And that's what makes us exceptional. So the whole point of action theory here, I don't like action theory particularly. It's you know, slices things into pieces that, in reality, is more complicated. I think, however, that identifying those steps is useful when you try to compare things, when you have the impression that something is more complex or less natural, something else. Try to see, is it on how you go from the high level goal to the actual specification of the actions you must make? Is it in the what he calls articulatory distance of how you actually have to do these things, and similarly for perception? And the reason why I don't like it is because it also tends to give the impression that everything is sort of planned in advance. That, you know, when you say you're going to write this report, you know exactly all the sequences of steps and everything is going to go. No, life is not like that. And so Lucy Sachman in the, this was in the late 80s, did her PhD dissertation at Park, and she was observing people using photocopiers. And she wrote this thesis, which was published as a book, which has had a huge impact. She's an anthropologist by training. So an anthropologist, studying a tribe of computer scientists at Xerox Park. And she made these observations that, yes, people have plans. You do plan on how something is going to happen. If you, you know, when you get up in the morning, you plan things in advance. You know when you should leave. You know that you can go take the bus and etc. And then shit happens. The bus is late. It's raining. I forgot something. So you adapt, and that's the situated action part. And so she studied how people kind of negotiate the thing between, you know, the imagined sequence of actions and what's really happening, and how they have to make micro decisions. And some of these decisions are made on the spot and are triggered by the environment, by, you know, what is the local context. So the point here is action is situated. And the more general picture of this is when you design interfaces, you have to take into account where they're going to be used, by whom they're going to be used. The fact that people will not use them the way you have anticipated. They will adapt the system to their way of working. There was a wonderful example at Park, at Xerox, not Park, Xerox, the company. They had this whole ordering system to order photocopiers. And so the deal is you order a photocopier, and then at some point they can deliver it to you. So they tell you, well, where shall we deliver it? And you give them an address, and that goes into the form. And once they have the address, they can actually send it to the shipping company that start delivering it. And then one day they get this order, and when they call the person and say, well, at what address shall we deliver it? The answer is, well, when are you going to deliver it? And she says, well, I don't know, it depends on the address. And he says, I don't know, it depends on the time. Why? The guy is on a ship, and the ship moves. So depending on when you can get the copier, you can tell them which port he's going to be in. And the system was not designed to do that. You could not continue the order if you couldn't give an address. So they had to cheat with the system, give a fake address and agree that, you know, they kind of marked it so someone would call to do the actual address and things like this. So oftentimes we create computer systems that are based on assumptions that will break in the real world. So the thing about plans and situation and situated action is really to plan for the fact that things won't happen according to plan. An example I've observed many times when I was at LRI here at the lab, when I was not far away from a printer, is how people react when their printer is out of paper. And you have the good people who had paper. You have the lazy people who just print to another printer, which means you have a bunch of waste the printouts, because of course the next person who puts paper in the job that this person didn't cancel will come out. I have people who said, well, I didn't really need this thing printed after all. I mean, I know, it's happened to me certainly, all three. I try to be a good person, but sometimes you're in a hurry. What I've observed is that also behavior number one tends to go down as the number of people using the printer goes up. There's this notion that, ah, someone else will do it. Someone else will need to print more than I do with that paper. Even worse for his toner, because changing toner is a lot more. But I mean, this is just a tiny example, and you certainly can relate to that. So the last slide here is, yes, people adapt. People have a plan and then revise the plan depending on the conditions. This happens in various ways. So here's the idea: you're in this state of the system and you want to reach that goal. And so you do something and you end up in that state and you realize, ooh, this is not what I was expecting. So you have three big strategies there. One is say, whoa, let's get back to where I was to try over again. That's undo. Now, undo is easy if it exists. It's not always available. But it's kind of a safe thing. So you have people, as you get to know the system better, you can get into repair. Saying, well, you know, when I was here, I was expecting to be here, and instead I ended up there. So I can go back here to try to then go there directly, but that's going to be two steps. But knowing that I'm in this state, and this is where I wanted to be, let me try to go to this step, to this state from here. So you're repairing your error, instead of undoing and trying again. And then there's a third strategy, which is even more optimized, which says, well, given that I'm here, let me forget about this intermediate state and revise my plan, and then I'll continue towards the goal through a different route. Okay? So, you know, if you get on the metro or on the bus and you miss the stop, well, you can either go on the other side and then go back, this first thing. So, I mean, you can adapt this to various scenarios. The important point here, I think, is we do all the time use these three things. Well, one thing, it depends on the size of the steps and the cost. So, you know, it may be that undoing and doing something else is faster than being there directly in the particular system. So the costs are not all the same. But it also depends a lot on our knowledge of the system, how familiar we are, and how good we are, and how we have a mental model that matches the actual system. So we can predict that even though we've never been from here to there, we should be able to do it by this sequence of commands. And that knowledge you build up through using the system, internalizing its conceptual model, and building a mental model that matches the conceptual model. And you find people who struggle with computer systems and say, it doesn't work, it doesn't do the thing I want to do. They are really fighting. And then you have people using the same system who, you know, are completely at ease with it. They're using the same system, they have the same set of commands, they're doing the same goals many times, but one of them has internalized the conceptual model much better than the other. And that's what I wanted to say on this topic. You have any question?
So when you design systems, like, what happens? Like, I mean, if I want my user to like start and then end in the expected state, how can I avoid the current state?
Well, how do you avoid errors in the first place? How do you avoid errors in the first place?
There's so many variables to control.
The thing is, you know, you can try to make errors less likely, but don't think you are going to eliminate errors. So design for errors in the first place. Now, how do you make it so people make fewer mistakes? This is a very large topic. So there are things that we'll see in the design methods class on how to design for these things. You have, you know, entire volumes of recommendations on things. And it goes from making errors impossible in the first place. So the idea that a command that is not available should be grayed out, means that if you cannot activate the command, you won't get the error. It also tells the user, well, you can't do this. So it's giving information. The information it's not giving is, well, but this is really what I want to do. Why is it grayed out? What should I do to ungray it out? A good system should allow you to get help on things that are not active. There are other recommendations on when the mistake, because sometimes the error is, you know, is it an error from the system or is it an error from the user? Well, designers of interactive systems tend to always blame it on the user. He didn't do the right thing. Well, why did that happen? So, to me, it always boils down to the conceptual model. If people repeatedly don't get things right, it means your conceptual model is wrong. It's not their brain that's wrong. I mean, you're not allowed to say that, right? So that's one thing. And the second thing is working on the what Norman calls the image of the system. What is it that people see? Because oftentimes you get information that people do not see. I should have a slide here on change blindness. I know you've seen this video of basketball players. Yes? So So there's a short video of people playing basketball, and they ask you how many bounces are they doing. And you watch the video, you get to the end, and they ask you, did you see the bear? In fact, for half the video, there is someone in a bear suit in the middle of the basketball players, and you don't see it. There's another video that was done by a magician where he's doing this whole card trick, and by the end of the trick, everything has changed in the environment. The background, the clothes they're wearing, and the tablecloth and the table where they do the trick. But you're looking at the trick, you don't see all these things changing. So that's one of the things that happens in user interfaces is, but the information is there. But I didn't see it. So that's the kind of thing that trigger errors.
So we kind of give cues to the users to like navigate around.
Yeah. But as I said before, design is chaotic. Small changes can have great effects. Sometimes big changes have no effect. And we don't have a theory, we don't have an operative theory of this. So, you know, I can't have an error meter that will tell you how bad your system is. The only way to do it is by trying with users. And the reason in this class, not my course, but we do the design process. We don't just do a user-centered design process, we do a participatory design process. We involve users in the process. Because half of the problem is to redefine the problem you're solving. You're being told, give me a system to solve that thing. And in fact, this is not the problem. Because the people who have defined the problem are usually not those who are going to be using the system, so they operate on an idealized and often completely wrong assumptions on how people actually do the work. And people do the work, you can observe them all you want beforehand, you will miss the important points. It's when you show them prototypes or when you work with them to say, well, would that work for you? Or tell me how you do this normally, that you discover things that are actually important. And oftentimes you'll find that you'll save yourself a lot of work, because what people need is often not the most technologically complex things. Wendy worked with controllers, air traffic controllers. The one thing that would make their life way easier, they have two representations of air traffic. One is on the radar, so a spatial one, and one is a set of flight strips, pieces of paper, one per airplane. And they spend their time correlating the two. They go through the list to make sure they don't forget any plane, but they also need to have a visual layout to know if planes are on the route where they may hit each other. The one thing that they were asking, but it took a while for them to even be aware this would help them, is to be able to touch the flight strip and have the plane highlight on the radar, so they don't have to do a visual search. You know, we were thinking about all these fancy technologies, but that was the one thing. So you know, you have to be humble. I think that's the thing, is you can, you know, whether you have done that for 40 or 50 years, you still have to be humble and realize you don't know the users until you've really worked with them. And the subline to this is when you design systems for a wide audience, it is extremely hard. It's a lot easier to do an audience for a very targeted user population. If you try to do, I mean, I often make jokes about Word or this type of systems, but it's also things that are used by, you know, the security to write memos, by people to write novels, by us to write journal articles. It's used for so many different things that, yes, how do you make it so everybody finds it easier for their tiny subset of things they do with the system? That's very hard. Okay, so I wanted to move into the next subject, which was to dig into graphical interaction a little bit. And the reason for this is that we, you know, that's what we use all the time. And so you're very familiar with it, which is also the danger, because you take it for granted. And so I hope you don't, or I hope you won't after that class. I will skip the first slides because we already talked about direct manipulation. Just quick reminder of the four principles of direct manipulation. And I already showed you this, so here's an illustrated version of this indirect manipulation that is often what we have to deal with when we use systems. So selecting an object, getting to a menu item, getting to a dialog box, having to say okay, long cycle, and most of the time could be done more directly. So this last slide was about this notion of what is direct versus indirect. And direct doesn't mean I can click on it with my mouse or I can touch it with my finger. Direct has to be interpreted relative to the object of interest. What is I'm trying to achieve? What object I'm trying to manipulate? Is it that object I'm touching directly or not? As I said, sometimes interaction is valuable. So there are degrees of indirection. And you have to think about whether it makes sense to make it more indirect. The other problem that maybe is less easy to identify is what are the objects of interest? And usually when you start with a problem, it's pretty obvious. If I'm going to write a text editor, well, the object of interest is the text. If I'm going to write a reservation system, the object of interest is the reservation records in the database that the probably the system is using. But what you'll find is, this is what I would call the primary objects of interest, the things that are obviously what the system is about. But then you will find, as you design the system, that there are other concepts that emerge that help you to get a better system, in theory. So an example, if you stick with text editing, is the notion of styles. You know, when you do text editing, especially text layout, you have a zillion parameters. You have margins, you have font size, you have... I mean, literally, I went into... That was a few years back into the Word series of dialog boxes for everything you can parameterize about one paragraph, and I think I had 120, literally. So what you do oftentimes in those situations is you create abstractions to capture a set of attributes into an object, which is typically called a style in this environment. You have the same thing in Photoshop and in Illustrator, and gathering a set of attributes that it can then apply at once to an object, and that get remembered by the system across multiple sessions, etc. And so my argument is that, if you have identified this, if you've worked with your users and they tell you that it makes sense to them, well, it becomes an object of interest. But if it becomes an object of interest, treat it as one. Styles in Word are not treated as objects of interest. I cannot manipulate styles unless I already have a document. I cannot save a style sheet separately. Well, you tell me, yes, you can. You can, but you have to create a special document that they call a template, and you have to save as template, and then the styles are sort of stored in there. So they're still hidden in the document. To edit the style, I have to go through convoluted process through the menus to find the styles. They have made progress. It has gotten a little bit better over time, but I still think styles are not treated as first-class objects in Word. And it's the same thing in many, many tools. So identifying the objects of interest is really the key here, because it will define what you can call direct manipulation of those objects. If I make the styles more real in the interface, then it will be more natural for users to deal with those objects, and I can have more direct manipulations with those objects. Interestingly, when people are designing touch interfaces and they don't replicate the desktop version, they tend to do this better. And so I don't know if it's the effect of, well, maybe all the students we've trained finally hit the market and these things have an effect. I would like to think that. Maybe it's because touch interaction also draws you more to trying to make things more real. I think another factor is because there are more examples of good interfaces, people try to take inspiration from that. So, this is designing a nice direct manipulation system is hard. And part of the reason why it's hard is because we're starting with a very simple, primitive vocabulary of things. I mean, I'm going to talk here about mouse-based interfaces. On the last slide, which we'll probably not get to see today, there are things say, well, do the same with touch interfaces. So, try to get your hands on a tablet, an iPad or other, or use a smartphone if you have one, and try to go through the analysis I'm going to give you here for this type of interfaces. And then you have to start with, okay, what is the vocabulary of input? And what I call graphical interaction, it's not just things where there's a screen with stuff displayed on it. What I call graphical interaction, and I say I because I haven't seen a definition for it, is an interface where you have a visual display and you have one or more, but usually one means of selecting objects, of targeting objects. So a locator device, whether it's a mouse, it's a touchpad or joystick or maybe something tracking your eyes, I don't know, but you have a cursor that you can control. And the cursor allows you to identify some of these objects. And that's a primary means by which you have this loop where the thing you see you can operate on through the cursor. And so with this cursor, there's not much I can do. I can point, which means moving the cursor inside an object. And there you have to sing the thing, it's long. The smaller the object, the harder it's going to be. When you point, you can give feedback. Feedback is critical in graphical user interfaces to tell the user that the system is doing what he thinks it is doing. So here, you know, when my cursor goes over the border, maybe I highlight the border. And when it goes inside, maybe I highlight the inside. This is an example. I mean, for some objects, it doesn't matter if I'm on the border or inside, actually, it's all the same. But if you have this feedback, you will improve, you will reduce errors. And you will also improve the sense of what objects can react. And then you have selection. It's important to distinguish between pointing and selection. Because pointing is literally just putting the cursor over, and then selection say, okay, that's you I want now, so I click. And you know, we can click, we can double click, we can triple click, we can control shift click. And so the whole richness that we have in our hands to do many different actions with our hands gets boiled down to this thing. You know, whether it's a single or double click, and whether I'm doing a shift or a control click. So it's very frustrating because we have all this expressiveness in our hands that gets really ignored. And then we can drag. Yes. That's fancy interaction. So you click, you move, you release. It's a drag operation. And again, you want immediate feedback of what's going on. So it's called the ghost or the shadow in some cases where you're moving or reshaping objects. Sometimes what you do is a trail of ink, so it shows you the trajectory. And when we talk about drag and drop, I think it's very important to distinguish dragging. I should have put the word marking here. So dragging is an operation where you select an object, or part of an object, then you drag, then you release. And the resulting operation depends exclusively of where you started or where you ended. So you know, if I drag an icon from here to there, whether I do it directly or I go three times around the screen and I finish at the same point, it's the same thing for the system. So the trajectory doesn't matter. Now there are, as always, you know, nothing is black and white. I showed the other day this interaction where you move an icon and you get onto a folder and you pause and the folder opens. So obviously, in that case, the particular trajectory I followed affects the result. But it's at individual points. So if we forget this example, you know, mainly, what I'm saying here is all that counts is beginning and end. However, you need to have continuous feedback for the user to know what it's doing. If you don't have this continuous feedback, people will not trust drag and drop. They will not try it. They will not discover it. The other thing is marking. And the marking interface is one where your device leaves a trail. And we call it ink in general. And then this ink is either taken as an object that you've created in the drawing interface. It may be an object that gets beautified. So if you draw something that is sort of like a circle, so you say, oh, it's a circle, and it will turn into a circle. So you have this notion of the system, you know, making your drawing beautiful. Well, it's called beautification. Not necessarily more beautiful, but anyway, the other aspect of marking is when your mark is interpreted and recognized as something that usually gets turned into a command. So there are systems where you can, I think Firefox is an extension for that, where you can move along pages with flicking gestures. Etc. So here the mark, and I'll get back to gesture recognition later. So the point is here you have moving the pointer, clicking, variations of clicking, and then dragging. And that's what we use in terms of input for creating 99% of the user interfaces in use today. And so over the years, a number of things have sort of become standardized. And what I'm showing here is a list of tasks basic interaction tasks. It started. It was started by Foley and Van Den in a book on computer graphics, of all things. So I'm sure some of you know the introduction to computer graphics. Do you have that? No? Well, if you're interested in graphics, this is the Bible, so you have to have read it. And interestingly, they were doing computer graphics, but they still had a chapter in there about interactivity. And they came up with this, with a taxonomy of tasks that they have then refined a little bit. They had mostly the first three, they didn't have this one, they had this one, and they didn't have exactly this one. So I sort of tweaked it. But interestingly, this was done by computer graphics people, and I haven't seen something as useful from HCI, but sometimes, you know, you have to be outside the field to see the light. So, I'm going to go fairly quickly through this. A lot of this is things you know. Not in the next class, but the one after, we will talk about post-swim interaction techniques. We will get back to this task and see some examples of more recent work that has tried to create more interesting things. So, one thing that I find important in this classification is the distinction between input tasks and selection tasks. So it's the first two in the list here. Because essentially what you do with a computer is one of two things. Either you give it new information that it didn't have, or you select information that it has. I mean, if you think of it, that's pretty much what it boils down to. So input tasks should be used only when you have to enter information in the system that is not already there. Because if it's already there, it's usually more work to input stuff than to pick from what's already there. As we will see, we can use input tasks to help selection, but as a general rule, it's better to keep input tasks only when you input in new information. And then you have a variety of ways of inputting data depending on the data type. So if you're putting text, you're going to use a text field and a keyboard, or a soft keyboard, but you know it's usually based on a keyboard. You could imagine using voice recognition, but it will have this its problem, and you will presumably want to be able to edit the text afterwards. If you're inputting a single value, well, you can use a, of course, you can always, well, for many of these, you can boil down to a text. So inputting a numerical value, I can certainly type it in, but I can also use a slider. If I have a very large range, I can use a rotary knob that turns forever. And then you get issues of, well, what is the range and what is the resolution I need? So you'll find various techniques. I think there are some in the list of techniques we have where the resolution, you can select with high resolution, with high precision on a very large range. I think there's a I don't know if we have the alpha slider or the Vernier slider. Now, if it's a 2D value, it's a position. Well, rather than entering X and Y with sliders, which sometimes is useful in CAD systems when you know exactly what you want to do, oftentimes you will just use pointing because the pointing device gives you 2D position. So, you know, if you want to draw an object, pick the corners, and that's easy. If you want to input a path, then we're going to use inking, as we saw before, to input the path. The lesson here is you want to use an input method that is adapted to the data type. It's okay to have an option to follow to get back to simpler or other input ways of inputting stuff like text for inputting a value, but you should have a way of inputting the value that is appropriate for the data type. An example, and that comes from Word, I think, is inputting the size of a table. You want to create a table in Word. Well, you know, 99% of GUI designers who say, I need the size, I need the number of rows and columns, will be put in a dialog box here, and people will enter the number of lines, the number of columns, in text fields. And then they will click OK, and then I'm done. Well, that would be the solution. A better solution is what you have in Word, where you get this pop-up where you can actually, you have a grid and you can select, and the thing gets bigger if you go down there. It tells you the size, and you get this visual thing that is adapted to this particular data type. Now, of course, bonjour Yacine, on y est presque. Of course, this is much easier to implement than that. And so oftentimes, the interfaces we have are poor because the tools that the designers had to create it made it easier to do something like this than something like that. And that's why the next course, well, after I'm done with this, which will overlap the next lecture, but that's why I want to talk about tools and show why we have this problem. And then, so it would be interesting to find other examples of systems you know where you know a particular type of input has been particularly well done and not done in the stupid way, because it's not that frequent. In fact, when you get to it, I'm going to go quickly through the selection tasks just so you get an outline. So selection is about choosing one or several items within a set. So whether you want to choose only one or several will tend to affect the type of technique. And whether the set tends to be small, medium size, or very big also will change the technique. And whether the set is always the same, like if I have to pick an alignment between left, right, and center, is not going to change. Or if it's a set that changes over the course of the session, like selecting a file in the file system, that will affect the technique. And you know those techniques. If it's a fixed size set, I tend to have things like menus, checkboxes, and radio buttons. Because I can have a fixed layout. It would be strange. There are systems who do that. You'll find exception to everything. But menus that change, not very good. Except for things like a menu of open windows or a menu of fonts, although fonts tend to be too many fonts now to put them in the menu. So, yeah, but in general, try to keep the menu fixed because people use muscle memory. They anticipate where a command is. They move there before the menu appears. So don't screw them up by flipping stuff in the menu or having menus that change size. I say that when Microsoft famously did the mistake in Windows XP. Checkboxes is for on-off options, as you know. Radio buttons is one of n. Again, don't make things where the number of radio buttons is going to change. It's not what it was designed for. When you go to variable size sets, well, you can have things like a visual display with icons, and then people can maybe lay out the icons. I think iconic interaction is not used enough, personally. More often, you would go to a list display. And then you have the issue of selecting in the list. So selecting that's for multiple selection. Typically what you have is things like selecting a range, so beginning and end. But frankly, it's not that frequent that the stuff you want to select happens to be next to each other. So you also need to be able to select these joint selections. One way to do it when you have a very long list is to have a dual list, where you add to the list of the selection from the list of possibilities. And that's nice because if your list is long, you have to scroll. If you have to scroll, you don't know what you have selected. So if you can't show all the selection at once, you should use a separate list. Doing this interface right is not that easy. When you select something here and you have put it here, should it disappear from here? And we lack stability. My recommendation would be to grade out, to say, well, it's selected, but if you grade out, it looks like it's not available, so maybe it's a different... So, I mean, you see all these details. I could go on this for hours, so I'm trying to go fast, but there are a zillion decisions and a zillion variants, and the fact that each major platform has come up with a set of widgets that they want you to use in a certain way is both good and bad. It's good for homogeneity, consistency, people get used to it. But oftentimes, there are situations where you want to, you know, give it a different twist. But if you do it, you break this consistency. So what we'd like to have is some of these widgets be more powerful, do more things, and then you can select the subset you're interested in. There's also the idea of combining techniques. So when you have a long list, you want to be able to select by going to the item, but also by typing. So sometimes, even though inputting stuff is usually more expensive than looking for stuff, when you have a very large set, you usually know what you're looking for, and if you can type it or input the data to an information to search for it, it can be faster. And more we are dealing with more and more data. So more and more we're moving from interfaces that where you go and pick things to interfaces where you do things through queries, doing a search first and then within that search picking what you want. With the list, what works well is you start typing and the list will dynamically filter things. Another option, if you don't have space, is the text field, and as you type, the possibilities are listed underneath, like Google does, for example. But keep in mind, these are all variants around this simple notion of selection tasks. And then there's a whole world of menus. And you can take, I mean, I could give you a 24 hours course on menus. There's big literature of menus, and so I'm going to stop here for today. But we know the standard menus with pull-down menus. We know fixed palettes, which are menus that are just, you know, with icons instead of words, but they are exactly the same. We know contextual menus that pop up when you need them and then disappear. We know hierarchical menus, so you can stuff more things without increasing the size too much. Maybe you don't know or don't remember pull-off menus. The advantage of the pull-down menus, they don't take space, and you know where to find it. But going to the menu bar all the time takes time. Contextual menus appear where you need them, so it's efficient. But you need to bring them up. A fixed palette is nice because it's always there. You can bring it next to where you work, but it takes room. So with each of these, you have a different trade-off, whether it's easy to find, whether it's efficient to get to, or whether it takes up room or not. Well, the pull-off menu gives you some flexibility. I can use it as a pull menu if I don't use it very often. But if I'm going to have to use commands in there repeatedly for a while, I can pull it off. And that was done in HyperCard originally. You click on the menu bar and you make a quick gesture and the menu becomes a fixed palette that you can put next to your working area and you work with it. When you're done, you close it, and that's it. So it's just to give you a little quick selection of these techniques. And then there are things you probably didn't even dream that could exist. Menus that you can select in constant times, high menus. Menus that you can select not only by selecting in the menu, but also by doing a gesture. And more menus, and some of them are in the list. And I hope some of you will explore these. So when we look at selection techniques, it's really a very rich world. And what we'll do next time, I'll get back a little bit on this, and then we continue with the other tasks. And then we'll have a TA session on looking at this on touch-based interfaces. So do you have any question? I'm going to call in the team.